Okay, so I'd like to start by thanking Martin for inviting me. What could be more fun than we get to spend the morning talking about a topic that we're all really interested in, and so I was very glad to be asked. My topic is to talk about relationships between snow depth, soil freezing, and nitrogen losses. And I'd like to acknowledge a couple of postdoctoral researchers that are working with us who are leading and carrying out a lot of the current work on this topic. I'd also like to acknowledge a rather large group of people. So the work I'm going to talk about is done at the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest, which is a long-term ecological research site in New Hampshire in the U.S. And we've had a large group of people working on winter climate change at Hubbard Brook for quite a while with funding from the National Science Foundation. We've had a group of postdocs and principal investigators and students, and it's been a nice effort. The Forest Service, the Hubbard Brook is a site run by the U.S. Forest Service, and so we have some really long-term data sets, right? So they've been collecting data on snow and soil frost for over 50 years. Gene Likens is one of the long-term workers at Hubbard Brook, and he's got a 50-year data record on ice cover on a lake in the Hubbard Brook Valley. And a lot of the work at Hubbard Brook is focused on nitrogen and nitrogen exports. And so people have spent a lot of time staring at the long-term record of nitrogen export from our watersheds at Hubbard Brook. And there's been quite a bit of interest that changes in winter climate. These exports are dominated by snowmelt. And so there's been lots of interest in the effects of changes in winter climate on the long-term record there. And then more recently, there have been these manipulation studies, which I've been involved in, with where we've done some shoveling to manipulate snow and soil freezing, and then also some natural gradient studies, which I'll talk about as well. So we did several rounds of these shoveling manipulation studies, and we got some interesting results, which I've tried to summarize on this slide. But in general, we shoveled snow out of the woods, the soil froze, and then nutrients came pouring out the bottom. So there were just huge losses of nitrogen, phosphorus, and base cations came leaching out the bottom. We had big changes in gases. We had increases in nitrous oxide flux. We had decreases in methane uptake. And basically, these relatively mild soil freezing events that we induced by shoveling were a significant disturbance to the northern hardwood forest ecosystem. It kind of showed the symptoms of classic nitrogen disturbance, similar to these clear-cutting or insect outbreaks experiments that have been done in Hubbard Brook. You disturb the system, and you get big increases in nutrient leaching, and then changes in gas emissions as well. And we felt most of this appeared to be driven by changes in root mortality. So in soils that we had shoveled and there was freezing, there was a doubling of overwinter root mortality. Plants kind of dominate the nitrogen cycle in these forests, and so there's less plant uptake, and so you get a looser nitrogen cycle, you get more leaching losses, and you get these changes in gases as well. So rather than rehash these old results in some detail, I thought I would review these here, and then today kind of talk about some of the current questions that we're wrestling with and some of the ongoing research at Hubbard Brook. And in particular, there were three questions that I was hoping to address. A little bit about methods. How can we go about studying winter climate change and relationships between snow depth and soil freezing? Second, there's this question of where are we going with winter climate? Are we, one of the titles of our projects has been, we're going to have colder soils in a warmer world. That we have less, in a warmer world, we have less snow. So we're losing the insulating blanket of snow. And so somewhat surprisingly, we're going to have colder soils in a warmer world. Maybe. Right? So that's one of the questions that we're addressing. Will we really have colder soils in a warmer world because we're losing snow? Martin alluded to this earlier. We've been getting variable responses. So in our work at Hubbard Brook, sometimes we shovel the snow, the soil freezes, and nutrients come pouring out the bottom. Sometimes we shovel the snow, the soil freezes, and that doesn't happen. And there have been variable results in other parts of the world as well. And so this is, that's why it's great to have this symposium. We get to get together and talk about why are we getting variable responses to soil freezing and what might be causing that. So we're going to go through these three questions. Okay, so how do we go about studying this? Right, there are basically two approaches. There's manipulations and there's gradients. So we do some shoveling to remove the snow. You can also put up snow shelters, and I'll show a picture of some clever snow shelters. And if you're in a place where there aren't trees and where the wind blows, it's great. You put up a fence, and the wind blows, and the snow piles up on one side of the fence, and then there's less snow on the other side of the fence. And these manipulations they allow you to do controlled experiments. But as with any controlled experiments, we wonder about the realism of these manipulations. And also we're isolating the winter effect. And of course we know the climate is changing both in the winter and the summer. And so the manipulations that manipulate just winter conditions are, it's good and it's bad. It allows us to isolate the winter effect, but it allows us to study a winter effect without considering that it's changing in the summer as well. Gradient studies, and in particular here I'm referring to elevation gradients. So if I sample it's warmer at the bottom of the hill than at the top of the hill. There are differences in snow depth and in soil freezing along these gradients. Can we use these elevation gradients as a space for time substitution? It does allow us to study winter and summer climate change or variation at the same time. And it allows us to look at the long-term effects. So the bottom of the hill has been experiencing a warmer climate for a long period of time. You could make the case that the top of the hill has the climate that used to be at the bottom of the hill, and it allows you to study the longer-term effects rather than just the disturbance effects. And but of course, gradients in gradients, we always agonize about, is climate the only thing that's changing along the gradient? And so both these have strengths and weaknesses. Here's a picture of one of our plots at Hubbard Brook. So we shovel, these are 10-meter by 10-meter plots, and we're able to keep these snow-free. We keep these snow-free through the end of January, and then snow piles up in February and March so that you don't get a drought effect. And we've been pretty happy. We've developed these methods where we can keep the plots snow-free without destroying the soil physical conditions and without trampling the plots. And I guess the happiest I am about them is they actually look like what really happens every now and again at Hubbard Brook. So here's a picture taken at Hubbard Brook in February. There ought to be a meter of snow on the ground. But what we see in certain years are these snow droughts. When you get out there in February and there's no snow and the soil is frozen, even the stream is frozen in this case. And it kind of makes me feel better that this our plots look like that. And so I think we're actually doing a reasonable simulation in our manipulations of what actually occurs in the real world. Shoveling is probably not the most sophisticated way to manipulate snow. And in Sweden, this is a picture from Sweden, the Crickland catchment, they have built shelters. And so in these shelters, the snow piles up in the shelter all winter long, and then at the end of the winter, they open a trap door, and then all the snow is delivered to the plot. And also in Sweden, they also are trying to simulate increased snow, where they have these bags filled with styrofoam beads, and so you can get extra insulation. And so this is a more sophisticated approach to the snow manipulation than shoveling. But the thing that's really impressive to me is that they've done it for long term. So how many years, Matt? It's almost 10 years.
I think it's since 2002.
Yeah, so they've been at this for a long time in the Creekland catchment. And shoveling works. Okay, so here's data. I have four sites at Hubbard Brook in 2003 and 2004, and I have reference plots and I have freeze treatment plots. And if I remove the snow, the soil freezes, and the soil freezes to great depth. So you can see natural soil frost is between 5 and 10 centimeters, and when I remove the snow, they freeze pretty deep, between 35 and 50 centimeters. So you gotta love this, right? So this is a great, I'm doing manipulation, I am getting an experimental difference. But of course, I've never seen 35 centimeters of soil frost at Hubbard Brook, right? So it's a treatment, but as in all treatments, we worry that the treatment is perhaps a little bit unrealistic. But shoveling works. So our concerns about shoveling, and also, I just got concerned about the shoveling. So we started to explore the elevation gradient at the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest as a venue for our winter climate change. So we have about 500 meters of elevation at Hubbard Brook. We have it gives us a 2 degrees C difference in mean annual temperature, and there's very little difference in soil and vegetation as we go along that gradient. And of course, very little is a poorly defined term. But that's what we always wrestle with in gradient studies. We'd like to know that the only thing that's varying along this gradient is climate, and I think we do pretty well with that at Hubbard Brook. And so we've been locating plots. So in the current work, we've got 20 plots located across this gradient. And so the first thing to explore here is this idea of, will we really have colder soils and more soil freezing in a warmer world? And again, the idea is you're losing snow, and so even if the world is warmer, if you lose snow, you might have more soil freezing. To me, it's like graduate student housing, right? So when I was a graduate student, I lived in a house, I went to graduate school in Georgia, and there was no insulation in my house. It's not very cold in Georgia, but I've never been colder than when I lived in January in Georgia, because there was no insulation in the house. And so And most of us, this always goes over well with academic audiences because we all lived in graduate student housing at various points. Okay, so but there's this question about we're losing the insulation, but the world's getting warmer, so will we really have warmer temperatures and a snowpack? And then and also the nature of soil freezing is quite important. So there's this question of a state change. That are we basically shifting soils from a winter state where they're unfrozen to a winter state where they're frozen, which, as Claudia shows, has very significant effects on overall winter performance. And then we're also concerned about the change in the disturbance regime or the change in the freeze-thaw cycles at either side. And again, both these are very important, and we think that we can study these along elevation gradients without manipulating the system. And then there's this question of, can you use the elevation gradient as a space for time experiment, where the top of the hill has the climate that used to be at the bottom of the hill, but is no longer there. So we started with this just last winter, and we have 20 of these plots strung out along the elevation gradient. And this is mean snow depth over the course of the whole year, and there's really quite a bit of range. This elevation gradient, this is a nice variation in snow depth, basically just about a factor of 2. This is mean seasonal snow depth over the course of the year. The problem with this is that it snowed like crazy last winter. It was a big snow year, and so even though we had variation, our mean snow depth was pretty high. It wasn't a great year for soil freezing at Hubbard Brook. We did see that there are strong relationships between snow depth and soil frost within a season. So here are 6 of my plots, and you can see over the course of the year, the snow depth goes up, and the amount of soil frost goes down. And we see this very robustly across the landscape as the snowpack develops. There's just a very strong relationship between snow depth and soil frost. And we see that very nicely in our landscape studies. The problem is this is a pathetic amount of soil frost because there's just a boatload of snow. I mean, it just snowed like crazy. So we're going to continue this for at least another couple of years. But I'm excited that the elevation gradient's giving us really like a factor of 2 difference in snow accumulation. And if the snow accumulation isn't so high, there should really be not, it should really be an excellent venue for exploring the relationships between snow, temperature, freezing, and climate variability. Now, some of our previous data suggest that the results will be quite interesting. So in our earlier studies, this is back in 2003, I had 2 high elevation plots and 2 low elevation plots. And snow pack starts to develop in early December at Hubbard Brook. And if you go out there at high elevations, there's some snow on the ground, and the soil is not frozen. Now, this is low elevation. It's really quite a bit warmer at low elevation, but there's no snow. Maybe the snow fell but melted, or it rained instead of snow. You get out there in December, and the soil is frozen in the warmer world. And the thing that's intriguing is that the differences, you set the difference at the beginning, and that difference persists throughout the whole year. So we had quite a bit of snow in this year, and the higher plots never froze. There was no soil freezing in the colder snow-covered plots, but these lower plots, there were persistent differences in soil freezing, again suggesting that a state change is important. And we saw the same thing in the next year. This was 2004. Again, here's my low elevation plots. In December, they're quite a bit warmer, and they have no snow, and they freeze, and then that difference persists throughout the whole season. And this gets you get you thinking about this question of state change, and are we changing soils so from a frozen state to an unfrozen state, or from an unfrozen state to a frozen state, and that can have significant effects on winter biogeochemistry. And perhaps even, we also know there are changes in freeze-thaw cycles here at the beginning and the end, and we know that those are important as well, but I think we can study both of those using these climate gradients. What it suggests, though, is that there are going to be these critical windows that are really important, right? At the beginning, it's going to set the state for the winter conditions, and at the beginning and the end, there are these freeze-thaw cycles, which becomes a modeling challenge, right? So we would like to go after this with models, but what you need to do is you're going to have to model the exact snow and temperature conditions during these brief windows at the beginning and the end of the season. That might be a challenge. Now, we've gone on to, in some of our earlier studies, in which we're continuing with. So we've got this natural variation in soil frost with elevation. So 2003 was a snowy year. There was more soil frost at low elevation than high elevation. 2004 was a colder year. Again, I have more soil frost at low elevation than high elevation. And we're also making a lot of nitrogen cycling measurements along these plots. But you can see I've got some, this is a pretty subtle variation in soil frost conditions, but it created significant differences in nitrogen cycling. So this is overwinter nitrogen mineralization measured with in-situ buried bags. And there's less nitrogen mineralization in the low elevation plots than the high elevation plots. These have more soil frost. They're warmer, but they have more soil frost, and they have lower nitrogen mineralization than these higher elevation plots. Colder, more snow, less soil freezing. And the difference is pretty big. So this is, we're talking about maybe between 15 and 30 kilograms of N per hectare less nitrogen mineralization in a colder world. So climate change, or a warmer world, is giving us a reduction in nitrogen mineralization over the winter. 15 to 20 kilos of N maybe is not a huge number, but nitrogen export from these sites is quite low. So it's certainly less than 5 kilos of N per hectare per year are exported from these watersheds, and it's all exported at snowmelt. And so there's the idea is that this winter N mineralization might be a critical controller of annual nitrogen exports from these watersheds. So we see these differences in winter activity, but then we wonder about does it really matter? So Harbor Brook is Claudia thinks she lives in the tropics, but you know, Harbor Brook is also, when I get a symposium like this, sometimes I feel like I'm in the tropics with people working in the Arctic and high in Canada. And so one of the advantages of working in these tropical regions is that things happen in the summer. It rains and the trees grow in the summer. And so the winter activity can be small. Can be only 5 to 30% of the activity. And also, we have summer climate change going on at the same time, and nitrogen cycling is very sensitive to summer climate change. And so we're left with this question of how important is the winter activity. But again, we have to remember that nitrogen export from these systems occurs during the winter, or it's snowmelt. And it's true for the nitrous oxide, as Claudia showed, and it's true for the hydrologic export. So this is kind of this open question about how important really the winter is, and this is an ongoing question. To amplify this point, so here's the winter mineralization data that I showed you in the previous slide, but it's on the same scale, and here's the summer mineralization, right? So it's on the same scale, and you can see mineralization in the summer is a lot higher than in the winter, and the differences between low elevation plots and high elevation plots are bigger in the summer. So summer has a lot of activity, and activity in the summer is very sensitive to climate variation, in particular, soil moisture. So here's my summer nitrogen mineralization here, summer nitrification here, versus mean soil moisture fraction. And so mineralization in the summer is really sensitive to moisture, and the warmer soils, right? So I have my low elevation plots are warmer, they have less soil moisture, and so they have lower mineralization and lower nitrification. And so to summarize this, low elevation represents a warmer world, and we're having lower nitrogen supply both in the winter and lower nitrogen supply in the summer. And in the winter, it's linked to soil freezing, and in the summer, it appears to be linked to soil moisture. So both winter changes and summer changes, trying to sort out which is most important to nitrogen export or to plant growth or nitrous oxide flux. Again, also just to amplify this winter question, so this just total soil respiration over 4 years at Hubbard Brook, you can see there are really big differences in total soil respiration between the low elevation plots and the high elevation plots. The warmer plots have higher, markedly higher total soil respiration in the summer. And so, again, the idea that the carbon and nitrogen cycle may be more responsive to summer climate change than winter climate change. You know, the activity in the winter is low, especially for carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide, more important in the winter. But so we're really struggling with this balance between summer change and winter change. The gradients allow you to study both at the same time. Okay, here's my third topic, was why are we getting variable responses to soil freezing in different studies? We've seen this in studies we've done in Hubbard Brook. Sometimes we get a big response, sometimes we don't. There's been good work in Sweden and in Norway and in Germany. And again, variable responses appear to be linked to a variety of potentially important factors. So at Hubbard Brook, again, these are our old results. Back in 98-99, we had manipulated plots. They were frozen. In the following summer, nitrate came pouring out the bottom of these systems. In the second year, the soils are frozen. Nitrate comes pouring out the bottom. Very obvious in maple, a little less clear in birch. And so these were the first studies. This showed this really big response. In the second series of studies, which we did in 2003-2004, the response was much less marked. One thing you'll notice is, so the nitrate concentrations here are high. 500 micromoles are leaching out the bottom of these systems. In the second studies, nitrate concentrations are much lower. They're less than 100, we had some pre-treatment data, and then in the treatment years, this is in the OA horizon. These are lysimeters measuring soil solution nitrate concentrations. Very weak effects, very low concentration. We're just not getting a big nitrate response in the second studies. Here's the BS horizon, and you can see there's just no difference between these treatment plots and these reference plots. There's not clearly in these second studies, soil freezing didn't increase nitrate losses, hydrologic losses from the study. But why is that? Here's a graph that was made. I have to acknowledge Samuel Fashukani was here. He made this graph. And in the second round of studies, we had four plots. And in two of the plots, we got a nice nitrate response. And in two of the plots, we got no nitrate response. And we feel a lot of this was linked to vegetation. So the plots that were dominated by sugar maple, we saw a nitrate response. The plots dominated by yellow birch, we didn't get a response. This is consistent with our root data. The roots of sugar maple are much more susceptible to the soil freezing disturbance than yellow birch or other northern hardwood species. And so clearly vegetation plays some role in this variation in response between studies. But again, the nitrate concentrations here are low. Nothing like, you know, in the previous study, again, even with sugar maple, we observed concentrations of 500 micromolar. So vegetation's not the whole story. We think DOC has a lot to do with it. So here in the first round of studies, we didn't observe any DOC response. Nitrate pouring and phosphorus and cations are pouring out the bottom, but DOC was not affected by the treatment in the first study. In the second study, here's some pretreatment DOC data, and we see, this is in the OA horizon, we see higher levels of DOC in the treatment plots than in the reference plots, and pretty high levels of DOC, both in 2003, 2004. This is in the OA, and the BS is even more compelling. So there's no difference pre-treatment, but there were significant differences in DOC and the BS, leaving the BS horizon in these studies. So now, clearly, the freeze treatment mobilized some dissolved organic carbon. And if you mobilize a lot of dissolved organic carbon, that can inhibit a nitrogen response. We're mobilizing carbon, you can get immobilization, you can get denitrification, and that can consume nitrate, and so you don't get a nitrate response if you've mobilized DOC. Okay, that makes sense, but why do we get a DOC response in 2003, 2004, and not in 1998, 1999? Again, studies in Germany and studies in Sweden and Norway have gone after the dissolved organic carbon response in some detail. But I'm left with the question of why do I see the DOC response in the second study and not in the first? And I think that there's probably longer-term trends in ecosystem carbon and nitrogen cycling that are regulating the response. So at Harbor Brook, we track long-term trends in potential net nitrogen mineralization. And you can see our first round of studies were done here in 98, 99. Our second rounds of studies were done in 2003, 2004. And it looks like the system here maybe is poised to respond, or is maybe more vulnerable to a nitrogen response here in the late 90s than it was in 2003, 2004. Why that is, I don't know. And it suggests that there are multi-annual patterns in ecosystem carbon and nitrogen flux that are regulating the vulnerability of the system to disturbances like soil freezing. And this is clearly, I think, a topic for future research, which people are starting to get at now with flux towers and long-term data on net ecosystem exchange of carbon. We see these multi-annual patterns. They're important for carbon flux. They probably are very important for regulating the vulnerability of the system to disturbance during the winter. Okay, so some conclusions. I had three questions about a little bit about methods, a little bit about how climate change is going to really play out, and variable responses, and I'll give conclusions separately for each of these questions. So what's the best way to study winter climate change? I think clearly the manipulations and the gradients are both going to play a role. The manipulations allow us to isolate winter effects. They allow us to study mechanisms in some detail. But I think if we really want to address questions about how actual climate variability and change is going to play out, we're going to need to exploit these gradients, which allow us to use more realistic conditions and also to do winter and summer at the same time. So I think we're going to continue to see manipulations, but I think we should be fairly aggressive at developing these gradients. Will we really have colder soils and soil freezing in a warmer world? I think this is an open question. Eventually, if the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere gets to 800 or 900 ppm, and it's a million degrees, so we probably won't have any soil freezing at Harbor Brook. But for a long time, this is going to be a very difficult question to ask, and it depends on narrow windows early in the season and late in the season, is there snow? How cold is it? Is there an outbreak of Arctic air coming down from Siberia in December when there's no snow on the ground in Scandinavia? And so this is gonna depends on these specific periods. And we're concerned about both the state change of going from unfrozen to frozen soils or from frozen soils to unfrozen soils, and we're also changes in freeze-thaw cycles. There have been really interesting papers where people are exploiting long-term climate data and exploiting models to address this, and it's really driving this forward, but these some of these things are going to be hard to model. And so I say good luck to you modelers. And then there's this last question about why are we getting variable responses to soil freezing in different studies. Clearly vegetation plays a role. Clearly DOC plays a role. And I think there's good research on this in many parts of the world now. I think what's a little more challenging is this idea of are multi-annual patterns in ecosystem carbon and nitrogen flux poisoning the system or changing the vulnerability of the system to these winter climate disturbances. That, I think, is an interesting topic for future research. I didn't have time to talk about changes in hydrology and flow paths or changes in regional climate. So clearly certain areas, certain regions are much more susceptible to winter climate than others. And the hydrologic changes we're investigating, but I didn't have time to talk about that. And hopefully we'll have the symposium again and I'll get to talk about that some other time. Thank you. Lindsay.
Great talk, Peter. Love to see this stuff. How do you think the ice storm of 98 affected the results from the
research? Right. So at Hubbard Brook, we had in I'm going to tell all these Canadians here all about the ice storm in 98. Right. So in the northeastern North American ice storm, knocked off about 30% of the leaf area at Hubbard Brook, and I guess Montreal had no power for a week or so. And the next couple of summers, nitrate came pouring out of these watersheds. It was a huge response, and we felt also driven by a change in plant uptake. And because there was less leaf area, there was less plant uptake, and nitrogen came pouring out the bottom. And then when the leaf area recovered, the nitrate response went down. And so we're very interested in ice storms, and Lindsay led an effort to make an ice storm. So we're trying to do controlled studies of ice storms as well as these natural responses, which involves, you know, a fire hose and spraying it out in the tree. To me, the question with the ice storms is, are we having more of them? Right, and that I think is an ongoing question. And I guess the other thing that's interesting, you know, I showed that slide of all the people working on winter climate change at Hubbard Brook. Once we started poking around in the woods and paying people to shovel in the woods, it attracted all kinds of other people. Said, "Ooh, that looks like there's interesting things going on in the winter." So then we started doing ice storms, and people are doing moose browsing in the winter, and I think it's nice at some of these long term study sites that it you can get some momentum going and do it. Ice storms, I think, are going to be important.
So the DOC thing is interesting. So DOC tends to carry DON, which, if it breaks down, turns into inorganic nitrogen. So do you think that it's just that the process was more complete of decomposition of that material in those earlier studies?
So that's,
or is
that,
it
yeah.
something really fundamentally different
yeah.
going on?
So that's a good point. So in the first studies, we were exporting 500 micromolar of nitrate, and which I haven't looked at now to see, or Samuel is looking at the soil solution data in much more detail, and shedding light on these questions. So the question is, are we exporting DON instead? Are we exporting DON instead of nitrate, and would that DON mineralize later? That's a very good question. We'll have to look at that and see. I don't. The DOC concentrations are pretty high. They're like 600 or 800,
yeah.
And if it's 10 to 1. It's still not a lot of DON, but it could be part of it. Yeah.
Do you see a trend of increasing soil acidification in your ecosystems? Is that
well, certainly in the first round of studies, when we had this increase in nitrogen loss, increase in phosphorus loss, and there was a marked acidification of the soil solution. So there was an acidification effect there. Overall, soils are becoming less acidic in this part of the world because of controls of acid rain. So sulfur deposition has gone down quite a bit. Nitrogen deposition has gone down some. So the pH of rainfall has gone down quite a bit. The pH of the stream has gone up some. And soils are, of course, responding more slowly, but acidification is either stable or going up.
Do
a little bit.
Thank you very much, Peter.